It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Arson has been in the news lately here in Iowa, including that tragic case of arson that killed two teenagers in Guthrie City. Also before that, the burning of a covered Iowa bridge, the famous bridge featured in the best-selling novel The Bridges of Madison County. So this hour, we want to talk about arson and arsonists. We'll find out what motivates people to commit arson and what investigators look for when sorting through the ashes. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Joining us this half hour, Matt DeLisi is with us, professor in the Department of Sociology at Iowa State University, joining us by phone. Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Matt, you've done research in this area. Also joining us, David Linkletter, Special Agency for the State Fire Marshal Division of the Iowa Department of Public Safety. David in our Des Moines studio. Hi, David.
Hello, good afternoon.
Let's start with who commits these types of crimes typically and why. Matt, take a crack at it.
Okay, first I want to talk about a few interrelated concepts. So people often use fire setting, arson, and pyromania interchangeably, but they actually typify often different behaviors and different types of defendants. So fire setting is a sort of general phenomenon. It can be intentional or accidental. It usually involves youth. It often involves the negligent handling of fire setting materials. And it's usually related to impulsivity, drug use, and other sort of antisocial conditions. Of the three, it's the most innocuous condition. Arson is, in contrast, is intentional. People who commit arson are often mentally ill. They tend to be socially isolated, introverted, have prior criminal history, and they are somewhat similar at times to school shooters in that they'll have angst against a certain person or a piece of property, and for them, the use of fire is sort of symbolic of a sense of power that they don't really have. Arson's relatively rare. There's about 41,000 arrests each year, but about 4 out of 5 cases of arson are not cleared by arrest. And then the final type of concept relating to fire is pyromania, which is the most rare condition, and that typifies a person who sets fires, and there's effective physiological or even sexual arousal to fire, either to the physical existence of fire, the smell of fire, the process of setting fires. In the case of pyromania, the fire is not set for monetary gain or to cover up a crime, which are often the motives in arson. For pyromaniacs, the fire is sort of in and of itself the goal. And so depending on the type of fire behavior you're seeing, you can make different inferences about what the offender is like.
Mm-hmm. David, anything to add to there to sort of profiling the types of people who set fires intentionally?
I really like what he said. I'm not much of a profiler. I just sort of go and investigate the fires as they come.
Okay.
But I have seen situations similar to what the professor described, and I would agree pretty much with what he said.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about investigations then, David. When does a fire receive extra scrutiny as possible arson?
Well, it's really up to the original jurisdiction, the fire department, who arrives first. In the state of Iowa, the fire chief is in charge of determining the causes and circumstances of the fires in his or her district. So they will, if it's a little more involved or it's a little more complex, they will call special agents from the state fire marshal's office. Or if it's a larger department, they may have a fire investigator on staff full time.
Mm-hmm.
And we will respond and assist the fire department and sometimes law enforcement agency with the investigation, which starts at the fire scene. And we collect the data and analyze the data. And we try to develop a theory on what happened based on our knowledge of fire behavior and experience, past experiences. And we try to apply that theory. Sometimes we'll test it. We'll set up a burn cell and see if we can recreate a situation like that. And usually that's how we come up with our determination. The professor mentioned that only 20% of arson cases are cleared by arrest, which is absolutely true. In fact, to even kind of shed more light on that, maybe half of those are prosecuted and maybe a third of the ones that are prosecuted are convicted. So the conviction rate is extremely low on arson, and it's mainly because there's so many complexities that go along mm-hmm. with the investigation, because we are rendering an opinion, and that can bring along a lot of scrutiny. So we don't like to really call it an arson fire unless we really have enough data to, you know, convince ourselves that it is such.
Mm-hmm. David, that being said, what are some telltale signs that you would find at a scene that would arouse suspicion it was arson?
That's a tough one. You know, oftentimes there would be some circumstances that are involved that may trigger some suspicions, but irregular burning, maybe multiple areas of origin that started at the same time. You know, if you have an accidental fire, typically you're going to have whatever artifact in that, whatever ignition source, you're going to have an original ignition source and an original fuel package that starts that whole event. If you have several ignition sources and several fuel packages that simultaneously start, that I would call that a clue.
Mm-hmm. And also, this is all about fire. Fire science is a field, and so you're really looking for ways that what fire would not normally behave, and find irregularities there. Would that be a way of putting it?
That's correct. And a really good example of that is when we do our cell burns, we'll set up an 8x12 room with a couch, a chair, you know, some other furniture, and we'll set a garbage can on fire and we'll let it burn. And we will let it get pretty well involved, so the fire doesn't just burn the garbage can, but it extends to the chair, the couch, and throughout the room. And then we'll take another burn cell and we'll pour, you know, an ignitable liquid on the floor and see what happens. And then after they're extinguished, you go in, you take a look, and there are very vastly different, you know, burn patterns to take a look at. And based on our knowledge of how fire behaves, carpeting, you know, a horizontal plane on the floor just doesn't catch on fire, especially if there's no ignition sources nearby or whatever. So the aid of a fuel on the floor definitely helps that burn. So when we see, you know, patterns like that, we definitely want to take a step further and take a little more analysis of that, maybe take a sample of the floor, send it to the DCI lab mm-hmm. To see if something was present there.
Are there ways for a, let's just say, skilled arsonist, a fire setter, to make it impossible to determine that a fire was intentionally set?
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. Matt DeLisi, back to sort of the profile. You've done a study a few years ago where you compared people who were fire setters to people who were not. What did you find?
Yeah, so that study used a very large epidemiological sample, had over 40,000 participants. And in that large sample, only 407 of them had ever been arrested for fire starting or fire setting. So that shows you sort of how rare it is. And the DSM, the prevalence isn't specified, but it's believed to be 1% or lower. So it's a very rare phenomenon. But across the board, the 407 individuals who had set fires were much more antisocial. So we had a whole battery of violent, nonviolent, and other types of offenses. And they committed much more than the individuals who had not ever set fires. The other interesting thing was they were about 14 times more likely to have been diagnosed with conduct disorder during childhood. And they were more than 12 times more likely to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder during adulthood. So the general public, sometimes when they see a crime and arson, because it's so rare and exceptional, it sort of lends itself to this. There's a belief that they're very specialized in their antisocial behavior, that they only set fires. In reality, most criminals are very versatile in general in their offense behavior, so they'll commit a little bit of everything. And arsonists are like that as well, or fire setters are like that as well. So you tend to see a sort of a broadband involvement in juvenile delinquency and other sort of crimes. The other thing, big finding from it, and this is sort of from my practitioner experience, something that I believe is true as well, is arson as an offense is something that has a strong connection with psychiatric disturbance. And so probably of the criminal offenses, arson and sexual offenses are the two that jump out at at practitioners and at researchers as those that are going to have sort of extra interesting and extra intrigue to them in terms of the psychiatric makeup of the offender, certainly compared to other crimes like auto theft or theft or burglary. So arson, it's rare, which is good. What makes that bad is that we don't know as much about them as we probably should. Fire-setting behaviors in childhood is one of the sort of distal predictors of sexual homicide and of serial homicide. So it can be a very, very troubling indicator of what that individual is going to develop into.
Let me follow up on that, Matt, before we alarm too many parents out there listening, because fire is absolutely fascinating as a phenomenon. Yep. And when you're a child, it can be absolutely fascinating. So how do you separate a normal, curious fascination for fire with something that may later in life turn into something problematic?
To me, context is everything. So if you have a child who is involved in scouts, for instance, and has a fire unit in scouts or has just gone camping, then certainly an interest in fire setting would be normal. If you're from a family that is camping or has that's sort of what the family does, then certainly fire setting is a part of that as well. If you're from a rural area where, burning trash or burning brush is something that's part of the, family chores, then that would be certainly normal as well. Where it would be abnormal would be if the child is interested in or preoccupied by fire when it doesn't have any relation to their day-to-day activities or day-to-day life or any other, there's not a better explanation for it in terms of the context. So if you have a child who just really enjoys fire, is fascinated by fire, that could be something, a red flag that you want to pay attention to, because it's an interest that could develop in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. David Linkletter, when we look at the very practical reasons that arsonists commit these crimes, what do you see when you get in an area? They are trying to perhaps solve a problem in their own life through a fire?
Oh, yeah. Spider revenge, insurance fraud, or even thrill-seeking are probably the top three motives, I guess, over the years that I've
seen. Your business is not doing so well. You don't really want to run your business anymore. You've got it insured. So why not set a fire, collect it, and get out of it?
Absolutely. And we do see that on a pretty regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about the thrill-seeking aspect of this in rural areas. What will typically happen there?
I've worked in my years with the state. I did work in a more rural area before I moved to Des Moines. And I can tell you that it is it exists. The rural thrill seeking fire starter does exist. It's usually young adults will identify abandoned structures in rural areas and let them burn.
Mm-hmm. That's just a thrill. They'll alert some of their friends, go out and say, hey, 10 o'clock tonight, come over in this field and we're going to set this thing off.
Yeah, set a barn or an old house or an old structure. It happens, unfortunately, on fairly regularly. And it's really difficult to trace because, in the secluded areas like that, the fire may be discovered relatively late. The fire or the structure is built in a way that there's no fire protection built inside the structure, so it burns relatively easily. And, it sometimes will self-extinguish or the fire department. It's not sometimes when they arrive, it's not safe for them to enter the structure. They're just going to surround it and kind of go on a defensive suppression effort.
David, talk a little bit about the way arsonists act after they set a fire, because, hearkening back to this covered bridge that was burned several weeks ago and actually, the suspect was located because he was on site soon after, right, and actually interviewed by TV.
We've had, I'm not going to speak about that case, but we've had several cases over the years where people have returned. I've had cases where in a larger municipality here in Iowa where they were having a problem with some fires in town, and one of the night sergeants on the police department decided to start taking pictures of the gallery, if you will, the people that would arrive to kind of watch the firefighters work. And over the course of a few months, a suspect was identified, and it was through those photographs that the night sergeant took as how we identified the suspect.
Are you familiar, Matt, with the Bridges of Madison County bridge case, that and the return to the scene?
Very brief. Just that I know that the one time I saw the news and they said that they had interviewed him the day before. Again, it's not very uncommon for criminal defendants to go back to the scene of the crime, and to even try and interject themselves into the investigation. So it's not necessarily specific just to arson.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you've interviewed fire setters?
As a former practitioner, I used to work for the courts and set bond on individuals, and so I had interviewed a number of defendants who had been arrested or convicted of arson in their criminal career and or had been charged with arson for their instant charges. It wasn't part of a project to interview fire setters, but it was just I was interviewing them in some other capacity. And so there's a few who I can recall who I can attest had very versatile criminal histories, but had a number of those arson arrests, and they tended to be much more withdrawn, had some psychiatric disorders, some substance use disorders. Again, that sort of profile of the school shooter is the one that I think is most similar. They sort of felt misplaced and out of touch and liked the power of fire and what it could do to sort of destroy things or destroy people. So they're a very interesting type of offender to talk to.
Mm-hmm. You said that they are abusers, they want more power. Does that also mean, as we find in other typical cases, that you'll find often they were the subject of abuse, perhaps as a child?
Could have been. And one of the points that David made that I want to comment on, that he was absolutely true. I mean, most cases of arson are very instrumental in terms of what the motivation was, and it's usually financial. Or in the other case that you mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, to potentially kill alleged victims or witnesses to other crimes. And so those would be sort of instrumental kind of arson cases. For those who are maybe more on the pyromania side or maybe on the more psychiatrically disturbed side, the apparent motivation of the fire setting will be less straightforward. And so I can recall a case where it was a juvenile who rode his bike to a neighborhood pool and set fire to the hedges that were aligned on the front of the building, sort of right by the front door of the pool, and rather quickly started a fire. And this was in the middle of the summer, in the middle of the afternoon, at a very crowded pool. And he was quickly arrested, and they rather quickly got the fire under control. But that individual was in and out of juvenile detention and reform schools throughout his adolescence, and ended up in adult prison for a variety of crimes, including burglary and rape. So that's an example where the fire, you always want to look at the motivation of the fire setting. If it's instrumental, it makes more sense, and it's more likely that the defendant is not psychiatrically disturbed. It's when there doesn't appear to be a motive to it other than just the joy of being around fire and setting fires where they're more problematic.
David Linkletter, as a special agent for the State Fire Marshal Division, I don't know if you come into contact with fire setters and get a chance to talk with them.
Yeah, we do. We don't get too deep with them, but sometimes with some juveniles that we've dealt with over the years, we've interviewed them and kind of asked them what their motives were, what they were getting excitement out of it or anything like that. A lot of those cases are referred to somebody with a little more expertise in that area than
we
have.
Well, what is it, Matt? Perhaps you know about this rehabilitation of people with these intentions, with these crimes perhaps behind them. How do you work out of that corner?
Well, in the study I was talking about earlier, where they had these dramatic increased likelihood of having conduct disorder and antisocial personality disorder, the likelihood of rehabilitating those types of offenders is very low anyway. And so I would suggest that it's more prudent to supervise them in confinement because they're really more of a public safety risk than anything else. If you have an individual, David was mentioning the cases where you have juveniles who go out in a field and there's a dilapidated barn and they set it fire and they're usually drinking alcohol and it's kind of more of a social event. Those kind of defendants are more easily reached and more easy to rehabilitate because the psychopathology is just much lower. But if you have a sort of a, someone who's a habitual arsonist or someone who just truly loves in a kind of physiological way the involvement with fire, it's very difficult to reach them.
David, I wonder then, does the state have a watch list, a list of individuals who have committed such crimes and would it be better to watch them?
I don't know if we have a specific watch list, but we have had cases over the years where there, and these are rare, where there might be a person that has somehow associated with several fires that keeps kind of coming up. But you know, because there's really not enough identifiable evidence from the scenes, we're not able to, you know, have enough probable cause or anything to make an arrest. But yeah, we've had that before, and we've shared that with sort of in-house with our other agents.
You mentioned that a relatively small fraction of arsonists are caught. Do you see that improving, David Linkletter, when you look at the challenges of investigating the possible arson?
No, I don't. Part of it is a manpower issue. You know, fire investigation, really, there's two parts to it. They need to start at the same time. The fire scene and all of the legwork to, you know, track down witnesses and get statements from everybody immediately. It's critical to get that information right away. Sometimes if you just have one, you know, fire investigator there at the scene, you know, the scene is the most important part. To get done first, because it may not be there, you know, the next day due to weather or you know, permission to get on property or whatever. So it is a right now with the way we're set up, we don't really have the bodies to get it done immediately on all the cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay, David Linkletter, Special Agent for the State Fire Marshal Division of the Iowa Department of Public Safety. David, thanks for coming into our Des Moines studio.
You're welcome.
Matt DeLisi, professor in the Department of Sociology at Iowa State University. Thank you for your insights, Matt.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Coming up in just a moment, when we continue after a short break, we'll examine the use of anonymous sources in journalism. Of course, anonymous sources have played a big role in the flurry of rapid-fire revelations surrounding the Trump administration. I'll talk with Kathleen Richardson of Drake University and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Barry. How to use anonymous sources in journalism when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Anonymous sources. Anonymous sources have played a big role in the flurry of rapid-fire revelations surrounding the Trump administration and investigations into Russian meddling into the 2016 election and possible collusion with members of the Trump campaign. This half hour, we want to talk about when and why anonymous sources are used and how journalists should deal with information from sources that wish to remain anonymous and how we, as media consumers, should view reporting that uses anonymous sources. Joining us to work our way through the use of anonymous sources, Kathleen Richardson, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake University in Des Moines. Hi, Kathleen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You worked at the Des Moines Register for some 20 years, mostly as an editor. Also, it's worthy to note here, you teach media law and ethics classes at Drake University. Also joining us, Steve Barry, Associate Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa, co-founder and editor of Iowa Watch. Steve Barry, welcome to you.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
Want to make sure people know that you won a Pulitzer Prize in 1993 for your investigative journalism. Kathleen, let's start with you. Why are anonymous sources even necessary?
In some cases, people that where information is very important, and it's very important for it to get out to the public. People might be in sensitive jobs, be in sensitive situations where they don't want their name attached to the information that they're giving to journalists. They might be powerless, and they might be afraid that their job is going to be at risk if their name is attached to it. Or they might be, in the case of a crime, for example, they might be afraid of for their safety.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what are the conditions? You've trained a lot of students in your time, and you've used a lot of anonymous sources in your reporting over many decades. What are the conditions that make the use of an anonymous source an acceptable alternative? I assume, Steve, that when possible, we always want a name attached, right?
Absolutely. Well, I think Kathleen expressed one of the major reasons that you have to use anonymous sources having to do with the, a lot of times, not just the career and job possibilities and sensitivity of the source's position, but very often when you're dealing with national security matters, as we are in this particular subject, sources' lives could actually be in danger. So you have to protect that. And also, I want to reemphasize another point she made, is that this story must be, in my view, extremely vital to the public interest. And I think that is an important failing in the use of anonymous sources too often by the press. The stories that we're talking about here, and I tried to focus on six or seven of them, I think all of them fit the bill of being of extremely important stories. And if I had been the editors of these stories, I would have agreed to publish them. However, I would have added more information about the anonymous sources. In using anonymous sources, the reporter, first and foremost, has to try to negotiate a way that they can or try to get the person to go on the record. And they also need to explain to the readers why this source has to be anonymous. And they also need to be able to establish that this source, even though this source is anonymous, was in a position to know about the information that they are providing in the story. And again, in reading these stories that I've reviewed for this broadcast, I saw that particular criteria was lacking in many, many situations.
So, Steve, give us an example of where you saw anonymous sources were used well in a case in the past.
If you're talking just recently, I would say, what the story that was just done the other day, in fact, yesterday, as a matter of fact, when Trump asked the Director of National Intelligence and the National Security Agency Director, Mike Rogers, to publicly push back against the FBI on evidence of collusion between his campaign and Russia, they used current and former officials who had private communications with the president. That was the attribution they had, and they did have a physical document that they referred to, an internal memo that was written at the time that the communications were going on. That is, they were written when Trump was actually having this conversation, and then they had another source that gave them an overview. But this was again according to officials briefed on the exchange. That final source in and of itself was kind of weak, but it was used more as corroboration for the primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
I think the trustworthiness of those sources is that they had four altogether, and then they had the existence of physical evidence. And then I think another thing that sort of added to the Washington Post's credibility is that they were willing to acknowledge that it did not know whether Trump's approach to the Director of National Intelligence, Mr. Coates, existed. They did know about a physical document for the approach to Rogers, but not to Coates. So that added a level of authenticity. That little tiny detail, I thought, did add some authenticity to that particular story.
Kathleen Richardson, when you're looking at more recent reporting, do you see the bar set high enough when it comes to the use of anonymous sources, or is it about right, do you think?
You know, I think that most readers or news consumers probably don't recognize or know that the use of anonymous sources varies differently from publication to publication and even from one part of the country to another. You know, we see the news coverage that we're talking about here coming out of Washington, out of the New York Times, Washington Post, and other national outlets. Those kinds of news organizations are much more likely to use anonymous sources and perhaps have different rules, maybe even in some cases less rigorous rules about the use of anonymous sources than journalists in Des Moines or in the Midwest or in the rest of the country. You know, I was, you know, like Steve is getting ready for this conversation, I was kind of looking online for the different news organizations and the policies that they follow involving when they're allowed to use anonymous sources. And in a lot of places, you know, like the Des Moines Register, the Kansas City Times, that there's a lot more hurdles that the journalists have to leap over when they want to use anonymous sources. But still, you know, even places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, even though the journalists are dealing with people who are highly placed in the, like for example, in the intelligence community and things like that, the journalists have to have significant conversations with their editors before they can publish.
If you've just joined us, Kathleen Richardson is with us, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake University. Steve Barry, Associate Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner in 1993 for investigative journalism. Talking this hour about the use of anonymous sources, how they can be used, and I guess we have yet to talk about how they can be abused. But I wanted to get your reaction to President Trump's remarks on anonymous sources, tying it into the whole phenomenon of fake news and also realizing that fake news has two meanings depending on who you are. Fake news, I think, originally meant news that was not true. Donald Trump often uses fake news to describe anything he disagrees with or makes him look bad. Let's listen to comments President Trump made about anonymous sources specifically. This is from a speech he gave in February at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
I'm against the people that make up stories and make up sources. They shouldn't be allowed to use sources unless they use somebody's name. Let their name be put out there. Let their name be put out. A source says that Donald Trump is a horrible, horrible human being. Let him say it to my face.
Okay, Steve Barry, it sounds reasonable if you just give a sort of very brief thought to what was said there. Yeah, why not put your name to a claim that you are making?
Well, I think we've discussed the number of reasons why you can't in particular types of stories. But one thing I would agree with Donald Trump on is the very last comment he made is that, I mean, he was exaggerating, engaging in I think what he calls truthful hyperbole. But he was saying that let them put their name if they are going to call Donald Trump a horrible, horrible man. Believe it or not, I agree with that. I do not think that newspapers or any news organization should use anonymous sources to express value judgments, opinions, even interpretations or analysis. And you should only use anonymous sources for extremely vital stories, like the ones we're talking about here. If you make a habit of overusing anonymous sources for secondary points, minor points, for interpretations, that is going to destroy a newspaper's credibility on the use of anonymous sources when you really need them, when you are trying to report on a story of vital interest. So let's use them very sparingly so that when you do need them, people will actually pay attention to what those anonymous sources are saying. Oddly enough, this sort of surprised me when I was reading over these articles. I did note a trend in this little body of stories that I read. I noticed a difference between the Washington Post and the New York Times. And I think the New York Times, in these particular stories, about seven of them altogether, was much more judicious in their use of anonymous sources. And I found the Washington Post, even though I agreed with their use of anonymous sources on the main points of their story, I think they hurt their stories when they went further down in the story and started using anonymous sources for secondary points and using anonymous sources to express opinions and legal analysts. There's no reason to do that. It's not important. The story survives on its own when you make a major, major point. Don't ruin it. Don't reduce the validity of your story by relying on anonymous sources for unessential information in the story. And that's what I saw the Washington Post do much more than what the New York Times did in these stories.
Kathleen Richardson, do you share that concern of Steve's when the line is crossed even a little bit, it makes the use of anonymous sources less effective?
Definitely. You know, it's certainly a valuable reporting technique, but as President Trump's comments show, the downsides to using anonymous sources, the fact that it's easy for critics to discount the reporting that is done using anonymous sources, and it does undermine the credibility of a news organization.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example of where anonymous sources was just abused, gave journalism a black eye, to put it a certain way?
Well, there was the use of anonymous sources actually was called out in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was a rash of fabrication examples in the media. New York Times reporter Jason Blair was found to have either plagiarized or fabricated a lot of his stories. I think there was a reporter just about the same time at USA Today and Stephen Glass at the New Republic, and the reason why these folks ended up getting by for so long fabricating these stories is because they were supposedly based on anonymous sources that didn't exist. So at that time, anonymous sources got a black eye.
Mm-hmm. Steve, help us be more so discriminating consumers of news. What questions should we ask as news media consumers when we read an article or hear a radio report or a TV report that includes anonymous sources?
Well, I think there's several things they could do. I think the main thing is to look for the kind of nuance that I tried to articulate in answer to your first question. Look for more of a better description of the anonymous sources. Now, that can be very difficult. As someone who's had to negotiate with anonymous sources about how to describe, that is a complex transaction that goes on between a reporter and a source, because if you give too much description of what the source is or who the source is, you give its identity away. But you have to be able to convince the reader that this source was indeed in a position to know. And if you can report that the source is relying on a physical document, like a memorandum or like notes that were taken in a meeting, that helps quite a bit. I would also, this is more of a recommendation to editors as well. When you have extremely important stories like these that are being published now to the Washington Post, I think it is really worth the editor's time to start, even if they have to devote a little sidebar story, a very brief, short story, explaining what the newspaper's process, vetting process for determining whether or not an anonymous source should be used. I would even encourage it in the body of the story that you devote at least a paragraph, which in newspaper jargon is two or three sentences, in which you quote the line editor or the decision-making editor. In the New York Times, for example, that would be Dean Baquet. Quote him. He is the one who has to sign off on whether or not to allow the reporter to use that story. And Mr. Baquet should be required to give, not required, but he should be encouraged to give at least what his thinking was in allowing this anonymous source to go through. I think also the reporter needs to be able to report, and we used to do this back in the 70s and 80s. You would constantly see reporters saying that this anonymous source had been used in other occasions and his information had a record of proving accurate. That's an important piece of information that readers need to know if they're going to try to evaluate anonymous sources. Then I think what we're talking about here is something that the press is constantly harping on when we're dealing with government. We always want transparency. Well, I think that also goes for the press when you're dealing with anonymous sources on very important stories. We need to have some transparency as much as possible without revealing the source's identity. But we need to explain why we felt it was so important to use an anonymous source and how we went about making that decision. That can either be a sentence or two in the story, or if necessary, a sidebar, a brief sidebar of, say, six or seven paragraphs.
Kathleen Richardson, before we end this conversation, I wanted to make sure we got to a point with you because you teach media law and ethics classes at Drake University. Under what circumstances can a reporter be forced to reveal an anonymous source's name?
Well, it's a matter of generally state law. You know, federal law gives journalists much less protection, you know, from being forced to reveal names at the state level. Like, for example, in Iowa, a reporter doesn't have to disclose a source or turn over information unless it can be proven that the information can't be obtained any other way, and it's really necessary to the case.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Steve, what are your thoughts, and you, Kathleen, perhaps as well, fake news has been such a big word phenomenon this past year, 2 years. I'm curious what you think, Steve, the connection between fake news and the way that it's used in a couple of different instances and anonymous sources.
Well, the information, I'm not sure exactly what Mr. Trump means when he uses fake news, because he uses it in so many different contexts. If you take it literally, the information that anonymous sources provides is not fake news, especially if it's been proven true. And you go back to the Michael Flynn story that the Washington Post first wrote. Everything that the Washington Post wrote that was based on anonymous sources, that was referred to as fake news. But now the developments have come out, and everything the Post reported in that story based on anonymous sources has been proven true. Sally Yates has sworn under oath that everything she said, and those were things that came out in that story. So it's not fake news just because you use anonymous sources. And as Kathleen pointed out earlier, there have been cases where anonymous sources have been made up, and those are horrendous, and there have been investigations done, and reporters' careers were ruined, and those are definitely fake news. But the things that you hear, the term fake news is being bandied about so much now, it's even referring to news where named sources are being quoted. So I don't know what fake news really means anymore.
Okay, Kathleen.
It means fake stories.
Right, Kathleen Richardson, we have just less than a minute left. How are you dealing with this phenomenon, fake news, there as Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake?
Well, as Steve says, if information is true, if the reporter is doing their due diligence and doing their job correctly, then the information is true and it's not fake.
All right. We'll leave it there. Kathleen Richardson is Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake University. used to work at the Des Moines Register, and now teaches media law and ethics classes at Drake University. Steve Barry joining us by phone, Associate Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa, co-founder and editor of Iowa Watch, also winner of the Pulitzer Prize in 1993 for his work in investigative journalism. Steve Barry, Kathleen Richardson, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, it's Politics Wednesday, of course. We'll have an international view with Wayne Moyers and Jim McCormick as we, of course, talk about many of the places that President Trump has been visiting over the last few days and the foreign policy of the United States under this president. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton with help from Elena Thompson and Robbie Broad. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.